Now, without further ado, let's begin the discussion, which is going on everywhere throughout this great land, cannabis, and how, as employers, we need to respond and consider the brand new world of cannabis. So by way of agenda, we'll do a quick background. We'll touch on the current landscape. Of course, the legalization of marijuana. By the way, marijuana and cannabis can be used interchangeably. I don't know if that's going to be the case when we start getting esoteric, when it's sold on shelves of retailers, and will have names like Jamaican Jamma and other sorts of names that will apply to the particular product. We'll discuss impairment at work, the duty to accommodate, testing, policy best practices, and some concluding remarks. By way of background, so you start off, it's almost comical, because we all know that this area, as we go down the road and what you've already heard in the media, and we'll touch on that shortly, is that there has been a checkered application or anticipated implementation of the legalization of cannabis. So there's a lot of uncertainty out there, and it starts really back in some time ago with the medical purposes regulations. So what you see in front of you is the ACMPR. Well, what's interesting about that? Well, it came into force in August of 2016 to replace the pre-existing marijuana for medical purposes regulations. Well, why did that happen? That happened because it was found to be unconstitutional in that patients couldn't get sufficient access to medicinal marijuana. So as you can see, it didn't get off to a particularly positive start as it relates to the regulatory framework. And as we move forward, you can anticipate challenges, certainly. So that ACMPR allows licensed producers to sell authorized patients dried fresh marijuana, as you can see in that list, cannabis oil, starter seeds, and plants, so that patients can grow their own plants. And please note that licensed producers does not include dispensaries. And if any of you following in the press will know, in Quebec, that's actually an election issue. As it relates to the prohibition or non-prohibition of growing cannabis at home, those plants at home. Some take the view that that's going to promote, let's call it, a significant overgrowth of those plants. Young people are going to get access to it more readily, and that's a concern for some, whereas other people say, hold it a second, we need unfettered access to this medicinal product, cannabis. In terms of the ability to secure cannabis for medical purposes, the individual must have a medical document from an authorized healthcare practitioner or a nurse practitioner. So in other words, it's an authorization document, right? You can't just say, I'm going to use it, or at least up to this point, I'm going to use it for medicinal purposes. You have to have a medical authorization. And in terms of licensed producers, you have them listed on the Health Canada website. Last time we looked, it was about 102 nationally in terms of licensed producers. So what you have right now is patients, once again, are provided with an authorization to use marijuana. And if you'll note in that bracket, in the first point, it says marijuana is not currently an approved drug. That's interesting. Why? You may have heard the reference to a DIN number. And those DIN numbers are required for benefit plan purposes. So it's going to be interesting to see what the Manulifes of the world are going to do as it relates to including medicinal marijuana as a covered, open quotes, drug, close quotes, since it's not and does not have a DIN number. And my understanding is that we're much less than about 10% of plans currently provide for that. My understanding is it's probably closer to 4 or 5%. So we have a very limited coverage right now. And some say, of course, that will raise premiums. Others will say, well, hold it a second. That treatment may replace more expensive drugs. So if it replaces more expensive drugs for certain treatments, then it's going to take the cost down for premiums. So we'll wait to see what happens. But what is interesting, and I'll jump right down to the third point, is the number of active client registrations with licensed producers for medicinal cannabis. And that number right now is, as we speak, is easily in the 300,000 range. I mean, whatever we are as a population, 35, I'm not sure what the last count is, 36 million. In terms of total population, we've got 300,000 already as medicinal marijuana users. And of course, when we, as of October 17th, you're going to have the legalization of recreational marijuana use. So, in terms of the adult population and its use of marijuana, of course, it's going to increase significantly. And from one of the sessions that I actually recently attended, one of the experts indicated that in terms of predicted addiction, and we're going to talk about accommodation shortly, we're looking at 1 in 10 adults. 1 in 10 users, in effect, will become addicted. When you think about that in our workplaces, that's a pretty, some would say, scary prospect, that you're going to have 1 in 10 addicted. Okay? Now, remember, as of this moment, it's still illegal to possess cannabis, right? Except as outlined in those regulations for medicinal purposes. But October 17th is fast approaching on all our calendars, and I'm sure all of us will be going into the street and just waiting to see what happens on October the 17th as that day unfolds. I say that, of course, tongue-in-cheek. Bill C-45 is the Cannabis Act, and it was originally introduced in April 2017 by the federal Liberal government, and, of course, it outlines legalization of recreational marijuana use and sets out offenses, enforcement, and penalties. And there's a whole myriad of interplay between the federal, provincial, municipal levels of government, right? Municipal governments are going to also be involved in this process. So it is really going to be a multi-layered implementation. And you can rest assured that there will be lawyers involved in various disputes concerning the implementation. So that's not necessarily a plug for lawyers, but it is identifying what certainly we can anticipate the future to be. So under the Cannabis Act itself, adults in Canada will be permitted to, as you can see, purchase fresh or dried cannabis from either a provincially or territorially regulated retailer, or if that option's not available, directly from a federally licensed producer. Possess up to 30 grams of dried legal cannabis or equivalent in public. By the way, I'm told, I do want to underscore, I'm told, that if you take a sandwich bag, all right, take a look at your plastic sort of sandwich bag that locks at the top, you can fill that with joints to get up to 30 grams. So it's pretty significant in terms of the volume, as it were. And what we all learned in kindergarten, of course, the fundamental way you conduct yourself in kindergarten and thereafter is to share. So, of course, you get to share up to 30 grams or equivalent of legal cannabis with other adults. Cultivation of up to four plants. Now, once again, that is going to be an issue. Quebec, it's an issue. So we'll see how that unfolds from province to province. And in terms of, you know, making your cannabis brownie or jelly bean, that's going to take a little bit of time. That's currently not permissible to do that, at least in terms of selling the product anywhere in any store for the future. So the legalization of cannabis, as we've indicated, is October the 17th, 2018. But of course, retail operations, it's all going to take some time. For those of you in Ontario, of course, you're familiar with the complete reversal in approach from the Wynne government now to the Ford government, where in Ontario now you have subject to study, but a clear indication from the Ford administration that you are going to have retail, private retail, retailers that will be selling cannabis products. But as you'll see in the fourth point on this slide, in Ontario right now, effective October 17th, it will be an online retail distribution. But you're going to have sort of a hodgepodge of distributions across Canada, right? Which in and of itself, once again, demonstrates that, let's call it checkered application or implementation, rather, of the legalization of cannabis. So as you see in the third point, at the federal level, you're going to see restrictions built surrounding the promotion, labeling, and packaging of cannabis. You can think of it as, you know, something akin to tobacco sales. Obviously, young people is a key feature in terms of trying to discourage, of course, any consumption by young people, and of course, the prohibition of sale to young people. And of course, in terms, as we touched on moments ago, the supply for retail and online sales, some provinces are going to implement government-run retail stores, right? Online only in Ontario right now, operated by the Ontario Cannabis Store, to be followed by private retailers in the future, we anticipate. The SQDC in Quebec, online with a few government stores, BC government, and other provinces will allow privately run stores, Alberta, Manitoba, by way of example. So as you cross provincial boundaries, you're going to have differences once again in effect, let's call it the, at least the consumer distribution of cannabis. So you're going to have, of course, once again, this is for adults, so you're going to have sort of the near effectively the legal age for possession appears to be as it would be for drinking. Restrictions surrounding the smoking of cannabis in public spaces, specifically those frequented by children, parks, playgrounds, beaches, etc., right? And certainly in Ontario, right, it's basically, and some are almost joking about it, there's no place to smoke cannabis except in your home, right? You're not going to be able to do it, can't do it in buildings, enclosed buildings, you can't do it in public parks, public spaces, you can't do it in the workplace. So who anybody thinks that the Christmas party, I hope you're planning your Christmas party now, it's almost October, anybody at the holiday party who, right, is smoking in that enclosed place, clearly you cannot, right? And there's going to be, and just sort of bear this in mind as we chat about this, there is going to be from some a misunderstanding of what legalization means. For those who misunderstand or misconstrue the legalization of cannabis, for them, it may mean in part, I'll call it a free-for-all. Well, I can do it. It's legal. I can do it anytime I want, anywhere I want. Answer, no, absolutely not. Highly restricted in terms of where. Now, of course, as the edibles come down the line, that may, you know, create a whole different scenario. Of course, because you won't know, right, what's in any given edible and how do the regulations speak to an edible, right? Excuse me here. I'm just going to have another jelly bean here. Non-infused, however. So as you see, regulations around the edibles are going to be established at the federal level, probably within the first year of legalization, but we'll wait and see. All right? And cannabis for medical purposes continues to exist, think about it as a separate stream than recreational. Right? different stream because it's, in effect, a treatment for a medicinal purpose. Impairment at work. All right, not a whole lot, and really the message, as it were, from this slide is really, if you go down to the third point about where the government of Canada and frequently asked questions says, while the legalization of cannabis has highlighted this concern, impairment in the workplace is not a new issue and is not limited to cannabis. Well, you know, there are differing views on that. There are material differences, however, with cannabis, and we're going to discuss them. One of the primary material differences is the ability to even determine impairment as a result of using cannabis. Alcohol, we all have a pretty good sense of the ability to evaluate whether somebody's inebriated, from red eyes to the slurring of words to inability to walk the proverbial straight line, a whole host of, let's call it, observable cues that somebody's under the influence of alcohol. Much different with cannabis. And even the testing of cannabis is wrought with, and as you've probably heard in the media, in terms of the roadside testing, you can anticipate charter challenges all over that because of the reliability or the non-reliability of those testing. So, you know, when you look at this statement by the federal government, arguably you could say, well, trying to cover their own proverbial you-know-what, because we're letting the Pandora's box, as it were, we're opening it up, and we're trying to say, ah, don't worry, it's not really a whole lot different. Well, really? Is that true? Not so sure that's so true. Not so sure. So as we talk about impairment at work, look, similar to alcohol, you do not have the right to be impaired at work. Simple as that. And even now, medicinal marijuana. If I'm taking medicinal marijuana, doesn't give me the right to be impaired at work, particularly in a safety-sensitive position. And of course, the safety-sensitive positions are where most of the, you know, action, close quotes, occur in these situations for self-evident reasons. But at the end of the day, like any, even today, a prescription drug does not entitle you to operate a forklift if you're on a prescription drug that will create a material impairment in your ability to operate the forklift. Same way with medicinal marijuana. Doesn't give you the carte blanche, the license, as it were, to operate in an environment, particularly a safety-sensitive environment. So you're going to want, as an employer, to ensure that there is, number one, that you have a policy that clearly identifies, right, the concern, and including in that policy the identification of medicinal marijuana, which should already be there, together with recreational cannabis, to say that that is not something that's acceptable. But be careful, because a zero tolerance policy, by way of example, if you adopt that approach, what's the challenge? Well, the challenge is that if I'm a recreational user, essentially as an employer, you can determine what you want to do with me as a recreational user. But if I've now become addicted, then I have a dependency and the human rights obligation to accommodate kicks in. Or if I'm using medicinal marijuana, by the way, why am I using it? Why am I using it? I'm using it because I have an underlying medical condition. And in all likelihood, that underlying medical condition qualifies as a disability under human rights legislation, which means
you have to accommodate my disability up to undue hardship.
So, as employers, you've got to be very mindful of the minefield associated with recreational use. Let's call it morphing in, or at least alleged to be morphing into an addiction, and medicinal treating an underlying medical condition that qualifies as a disability. So in terms of the side effects, and we touched on that moments ago, and some of the, you know, the difficulty of some of the sort of, let's call it well-known side effects, as you see that list, and I won't go through that in any detail, but you can see quickly dizziness, impaired memory, disorientation, right? Suspiciousness, dry mouth, throat, coughing, worsening of seizures, right? That is not listed there, the tortilla effect, right? Or the right, tortilla chip effect, where, of course, you have that standard search for typically what is junk food in order to respond to a consequence of cannabis use. So all of that to say we've got all that going on, but of course some of those will mimic non-cannabis related condition side effects as well. But if you look at the bottom, there's no current consensus on safe limits. Yeah, we're going to see that in the test, roadside testing. But at the end of the day, that's where you're going to see some of the challenges. Because the impairment on any given person is based on a variety of factors, including the level of THC content, frequency of use, combination with other drugs. So it's going to be on a spectrum. All right. What about this? You have two people that drive together. Salespeople. One of them, call it Sally. Sally, as of October 18th, it's Sally and Jill. Sally, as of October 18th, starts her regime of nightly recreational use. Joe becomes aware of Sally's recreational use at night. Sally's, you know, 85 pounds soaking wet. And Joe knows Sally takes some other prescription pills he's not really sure of. Joe's a nervous type to begin with. Sally drives. What if Joe says, I'm not driving with Sally. I'm not driving with Sally. I'm concerned about my welfare given my knowledge, and she's been quite open about it, as a recreational user. But there's no certainty from Joe's perspective as to her level of impairment. There's an incredible decision that is an arbitral decision in the collective agreement environment, where you typically often see these things happen faster than in the non-unionized environment, where essentially an arbitrator held that the inability to test impairment caused undue hardship to the employer. In other words, this employee in the facts essentially wanted to work in another position. The employer said, no way, because we understand you're a regular recreational user. He said, no, I'm fine. And the employer established to the satisfaction of the arbitrator, there's no way to test. There's no way you can accurately know the level of impairment. So how can the employer just roll the dice and say, yes, go ahead and work in the safety sensitive position, employee? Under occupational health and safety legislation, there's an obligation to take all precautions, every precaution reasonable in the circumstances to protect the health and safety of the worker. Okay, what do you do now? When Joe says, I'm not doing it. I'm not doing it. Short answer is, of course, have Joe drive. But, of course, I didn't tell you, Joe, this is all, of course, tongue-in-cheek, Joe had an accident 2 years ago in the 401 and doesn't want to drive since then. So that's just an example of the problems we're going to face. Right? So this idea that, oh, it's just the same as alcohol, federal government, not so sure. Okay, so what can employers do? Well, certainly what employers should do, and I know when you hear people like me, everybody is scared and is concerned about anything they might say or do, might create liability for the organization. And yes, I get how that might sometimes be received as the message, but look, bottom line is you can talk to your employees. There's currently no prohibition about that. If somebody is showing signs of being impaired at work, you sit down and talk to them. Ask them, are you under some? We observe you doing A, B, and C. That suggests to us there may be something we need to know about. Is there anything we need to know about? Are you under the influence? You know we have a policy that speaks to the prohibition about being impaired at work. We have reason to believe, given what we've observed, that you may indeed be under the influence. Find out. If it's recreational, the Human Rights Code has no application. In other words, discrimination on the basis of disability, which means an addiction or dependency, the language you want to use, doesn't apply. So I notionally, as an employer, could say you're terminated immediately. Goodbye. Now, that may not constitute just cause in the circumstances to terminate, but I can terminate without an issue of human rights, which is the, I'll call it the larger issue. If it's for medicinal purposes, well, of course, we need to understand. First of all, do we have the authorization? And we need to understand what the limitations are, the impact of the treatment with respect to the person's job. In other words, we need medical support that's based on the job that that employee is doing, understanding limitations, modified work opportunities, et cetera, which is in that third point. Employers are obligated to accommodate to the point of undue hardship. Well, the only way we can accommodate somebody is if we get the information, the medical information, and by that I don't mean the diagnostic information, the information that sets out the limitations, anticipated return to work, if that applies, the information we're entitled and arguably legally obliged to obtain. Okay, so as you see in that fourth point, hey, if it's not an addiction, it's not being used for medical purposes, well, they can be subject to discipline. Recreational use is not an accommodation or human rights issue. Not. But what's an employee going to do? We're going to talk about that shortly in the Elk Valley decision. What will many, many employees, and we've seen this for a long time, with alcohol, certainly. What's an employee going to do if he or she reads the writing on the wall? What they're going to do is put up their hand and say, I'm addicted. And if you look at that stat I mentioned earlier, 1 in 10 will become addicted. Makes some sense, doesn't it? To make the claim that you're addicted. And what has changed dramatically over the last 20 years, dramatically, is the removal of the stigma attached to any form of dependency or a mental health issue. That's a good thing in many respects, no question about it. But it is a challenge on the other side, the proverbial flip side, where if you catch me in violation of the policy, where I'm a recreational user, I violated the policy, I showed up impaired, safety sensitive or not, but obviously more significant in a safety sensitive environment. I then put up my hand and say, you have to accommodate me because I am addicted. I'm sorry I didn't tell you that. But now, sorry, you've got to accommodate me. We'll talk about that and one of the ways to approach that when we talk about a Supreme Court of Canada decision in what's called the Elk Valley decision. All right, let's chat for a moment about the challenge, and I keep saying accommodation, right? That's what you keep hearing me say. Accommodation, accommodation, accommodation. Yes, because You have to accommodate, once again, the recreational user who evolves into an addicted user. And the medicinal marijuana user who's using it for an underlying medical condition, which almost invariably will be a disability. Under those circumstances, you have to accommodate up to undue hardship. So what does that even mean, accommodation up to undue hardship? Well, we don't have the time to get into it in any great detail, but I'll show you an example of how far that obligation extends. In this particular unionized environment, you have a nurse. Okay, let's get a sense of the nature of the job duties attached to a nurse. Well, she was in the palliative care area of London Health Science Center. Palliative care. And she elected to steal the very drugs that she was charged with administering to the palliative care patients. And charged with that responsibility, she stole it, used it herself, falsified records, and lied about what she did. Not sure any of us can come up with a more heinous set of circumstances as it relates to that nurse. So, of course, they learn of it, and they terminate her employment for cause. And that, of course, in a unionized environment, goes to arbitration. So what does she argue? She says, well, hold it. Sorry, doesn't work that way. Doesn't work that way. Damned if you do, damned if you don't, employer. You know why? Because of my addiction to that drug, I engaged in those heinous acts. To which most of us, if not all of us, our response would be, huh? Seriously? And yet, at least in this decision, this particular arbitrator found that the employer had an obligation to accommodate her disability, which caused her to steal drugs that were supposed to be administered to her palliative care patients. That, ladies and gentlemen, identifies how far we go when we talk about accommodation. Of course, this is an egregious example, but nevertheless, gives you a sense. Now, in this decision in Wilson and Transparent Glazing Systems, this is out of BC, Human Rights Tribunal, this gives you that Sally Joe example. Right? So, Greg Wilson is prescribed medicinal marijuana. By the way, take a look at why. Back pain and migraines. By a show of hands, who here has ever had back pain? Okay, my hand is certainly up in the air. I'm sure most of you have your hand up in the air. Now, there's arguments as we move forward with these treatments, the medicinal marijuana treatment, that back pain, the underlying condition, will qualify as a disability. Certainly in this case, it ended up, yes, although it's combined with migraines. But what happens here? The coworker complains about this guy being impaired at work. Joe, even though he doesn't see Sally being impaired per se, has a legitimate perception that she may be impaired. But in this case, actually observable conduct that demonstrates a level of impairment. So, they listen to the coworker, and they're completely unhappy that in a safety-sensitive environment, Mr. Wilson would do what he did. So they terminate him, but they say, nah, it's based on his poor performance, aggressive nature, and general unprofessionalism, which turns out to be true in terms of the facts. He was a poor performer, had an aggressive nature, and general unprofessionalism. But what does Mr. Wilson say? Mr. Wilson says, give me a break. You never said a thing to me about my performance, aggressive nature, and general unprofessionalism until you learned from the coworker about my medicinal marijuana treatment for my back pain and migraines. You should have and have to accommodate that disability, my underlying medical condition that's being treated by medicinal marijuana. They did not. And the BC Human Rights Tribunal felt as though it was pretty clear that the trigger was the complaint from the coworker. And it wasn't as it relates to the aggressive nature, general unprofessionalism, or poor performance. Okay, when we talk about, once again, that the disability and the duty to accommodate, the sequence that ought to occur is the employee informing the employer, and this is in any case where an accommodation is required, of the need for an accommodation, and provide the requested medical information to substantiate any request for accommodation. It is based on medical information, not the employee's opinion. Not the employee's opinion on preference as to, I only want to do tasks 1 through 6. I don't want to do 7, 8, 9, and 10 anymore. That will make me happier. No. It is based on a very, let's call it, significant or robust review of medical information that the employer is entitled to obtain from the treating practitioner and or specialist. Just as a, by the way, as an aside, one of the challenges in this area with cannabis now is the lack of understanding in the medical profession generally about cannabis. So the GP is no expert in cannabis. But what's going to happen is you're going to see, we have 300,000 users already, right? Authorized users. You're going to see, you just saw in the last case with Mr. Wilson, what was he prescribed? Medicinal marijuana for what? Back pain and migraines. So you're going to see a surge in prescribing medicinal marijuana for purposes of a wide variety of medical conditions, which now complicates life for employers. But we're going to need, as employers, to understand the impact of that treatment on the ability of the employee to perform the essential duties of the job and, of course, the accommodation obligation. In those unionized environments, you're looking at a multi-party inquiry. Look, the idea is, from a human rights perspective, is that everybody sits down, union, employer, employee, gather up all the relevant medical documentation and engage in a very forthright, constructive conversation about what accommodation may be required in the circumstances. That at least is what's supposed to happen in theory. Of course, when we know in practice, it can become quite difficult indeed. And just as a by the way on this, do not rely on your insurer and your insurer's opinion on fitness to return to work. The insurer has a different interest. It's the application of the policy and entitlement to benefits. You have an obligation as an employer to accommodate up to undue hardship where a disability exists. They are not the same. And so you will typically want to dual track it. Of course, the insurance process will have a life unto itself, but you as the employer need to secure that information. And do not hesitate to secure that information. And of course, in terms of the ultimate accommodation, right, myriad of options from time away from work to attended treatment, rehab programs, modified work hours, modified work duties, of course, the list can go on and on, subject to what the medical
sort of documentation identifies. But remember, refusing accommodation, it is extremely high threshold, a little bit crazy as you saw with that hospital in London. But nevertheless, it is indeed a very high threshold. And in order to satisfy a human rights tribunal, and certainly for those of you in BC, those of you in Ontario, it can't be easier to file a human rights complaint, right? It goes right to the tribunal. You file it online while you're looking at your guacamole recipe online, and away you go, government apparatus kicks in the gear. And it moves quickly, by the way, that process. So as an accommodation, you have to demonstrate very clearly, not only have you implemented the steps that you need to do, but ultimately you've come to a decision that demonstrates you've accommodated up to undue hardship to satisfy your obligation. So when we accommodate addictions, right, we've already sort of touched on this, it relates, you have human rights legislation that includes, of course, alcohol, marijuana, right, or another drug. I mean, it's a mental health disability issue, certainly the addiction, right? Prohibited ground of discrimination is disability, and you have that obligation to accommodate up to the point of undue hardship. So when there is medicinal marijuana in the circumstances being used, you know, you want to look at it as any other prescription medication, right? We need to understand, particularly in a safety-sensitive environment, how will that use impact the employee? Remember, once again, you have an obligation, not just from a human rights perspective. You have an obligation from an occupational health and safety perspective. Typically, the language varies across Canada, but essentially it's you have the obligation to ensure that you're taking every precaution reasonable in the circumstances to protect the health and safety of your workers, including the employee who's being treated for medicinal marijuana. This should not come as a shock to anybody, but often you now have treating physicians that don't have a lot of awareness about cannabis and often are not provided with the information from the employee regarding the work environment, the safety-sensitive environment. You have to make sure you're getting that information, right? The whole idea of impairment, and there's going to be challenges. When an employee says to you, when Sally says, I use recreational marijuana, but she has an office job, and her performance is not up to par, and we know that one of the side effects of cannabis is the ability to make judgments. So if judgments, and in most cases performance is often based on judgments, and those are not exactly the best judgment calls, now we've got this issue arising. Is she impacted? Is she impacted by her recreational use and showing up impaired, even though technically her position may not, I'm really not impaired. Now you've got this whole morass of issues. You can ask from a medicinal perspective for the authorization from the employee, right, if they're claiming they are using it for medicinal purposes. We're not going to spend a lot of time on testing per se. This, the bottom line on this is that pre-employment testing, although I'll just say technically may be available, Alberta's different. You can do testing. It's what you do with the results of that testing. But essentially across Canada, it's no-no land, even though there's some limited legal argument. As you can see identified here, the Human Rights Commission, certainly in Ontario, saying, no, we don't like you doing any kind of pre-employment testing whatsoever. So essentially, you know, you're left with, okay, random testing. Well, we're going to talk about TTC in a second, but good luck on random testing if you're anything outside of a major safety-sensitive environment. So what are you left with? Well, essentially, you're left with reasonable cause and post-incident. So if there is an incident and there's a reasonable basis to suspect impairment,
than in those safety-sensitive circumstances, you might have the ability to test. And then, of course, just because you test and it turns out to be positive, subject to the Elk Valley decision, which we'll talk about in a second, doesn't mean you can just pull the proverbial ripcord on that employee, because now what do you have? Everybody sing together. We have that obligation to accommodate, because that person, right, may be addicted as opposed to recreational use. Once again, recreational use, no limitation essentially, other than maybe what you're paying that person to exit stage door left. If they are addicted, or the medicinal treatment for, let's call it an underlying disability, you have the complications associated with accommodating up to undue hardship. Okay, so what happens with the TTC environment? Well, interestingly, in the TTC environment, what happened was they, a long time ago, developed their policy on random drug testing and alcohol testing as well. And they did that because they said, oh, we're in a significant safety-sensitive environment, and we've had issues. So we need to implement random testing. What'd the union say? Anybody guess? The union said no. And they brought a policy grievance. And so they, by the way, about 5-6 years after they initiated the grievance, they were still arguing at arbitration. The union side was still presenting as evidence. Anyway, they get so long in the process, there's so much time has gone by, the TTC finally says enough is enough, we're implementing. So they implement, even though it's before an arbitrator and still being argued. So what does the union do? The union says, we're going to go to court. We're going to go to court now and restrain them from implementing, get an injunction. So it was argued before an Ontario Superior Court judge as to whether an injunction should be granted in the circumstances. And there are special tests with an injunction that we won't go through now, but essentially what happened was the court said, you know what? There is a real safety-sensitive issue here. There has been a pervasive history of safety incidents related to alcohol and drug use. Therefore, I'm not going to issue in the injunction. So the TTC, as of now, is testing. Now, of course, if you're going to test, you have to make sure you have a bona fide a third party doing that testing. That goes without question. You have to ensure confidentiality of the process, a reputable provider, right? And of course, where there's an addiction, we have to address the accommodations issue. Okay, in terms of policy best practices, and of course, there's not a lot of time to deal with this, you want to make sure your policy certainly identifies in the clearest of terms that cannabis is a prohibited drug, let's say, as it relates to impairment at work. The third point there is what we're going to talk about, and I've mentioned Elk Valley a few times. We're going to talk about it momentarily. Require the disclosure of use of medicinal marijuana and other narcotics. But even more so, point four, create a duty to report addictions and or dependency before an incident. So in other words, I've got an addiction. I'm in a safety-sensitive position. What am I saying? Tell us. Now, the policy would clearly provide that we will enter into a process where we're seeking to assist you and not terminate, but come forward before the incident occurs. Okay, we'll talk about that. Bear that in mind. We're going to talk about that in Elk Valley in a second. If we've got a dependency issue, remember, one in 10 adults, the one stat that I came across was 40% of all adults in Canada will be using, whether it's medicinal, addicted, recreational, cannabis. And that gets the governments all excited for the tax revenue, certainly. That will be significant tax revenue, no question about it. But for the employers, you've got now another substance
that individuals may in effect use improperly from a recreational standpoint, perhaps not even know it, and then of course creating a circumstance for addictions where your obligation to accommodate arises. All of this against the backdrop of occupational health and safety. Okay, you're going to want to communicate your policy, no question about it, right? By the way, just as a note on all policies, it is never, never, never good enough. Never good enough to say I have a policy, it's on the intranet. Never. You have to be seen to be training on those policies on a regular basis, annually. Have the employees sign off. And not that you gave them the time to sign off on their own time. Paid time, where they had the opportunity to go through the policy again. Courts have definitely gone down that continuum towards employer, it's not good enough to just simply say you have a policy, you have to have communicated it, and on an ongoing basis. So now we get to Stewart and Elk Valley. So what happens? Obviously, safety-sensitive environment. Coal Corporation Mining. So he's involved in a collision at work, Mr. Stewart is, and he tests positive for cocaine post-incident. They had a reasonable basis, a reasonable cause to test him. They had the policy that provided for it. And they terminate him, not for the drug use, per se, but for not disclosing his drug use. Because they have a policy that said, if you're using drugs, if you have an addiction, you have to come forward and we'll work with you. But what did he do? Remember I talked earlier about putting your hand up and not worrying about the stigma anymore? Well, he just lost his job. So what did he do, Mr. Stewart? He said, whoa, I'm addicted to cocaine. So you had the obligation to accommodate me, Elk Valley Coal Corp, and you didn't. Sorry, reinstatement with full back pay is what I'm expecting. But somewhat remarkably, and it found its way all the way to the Supreme Court supported the company's position. They said he wasn't terminated. He wasn't terminated because of his addiction, if he had it. He was terminated for the breach of the policy that said, come forward and identify that you have it and we'll work with you. That's why he got terminated. And the Supreme Court of Canada said, we get it. And it's not discrimination, therefore, because it had nothing to do with his disability. So you want to have in your policies a clear requirement regarding the disclosure of addiction and dependency issues, especially, of course, in safety-sensitive environments. So just by way of, you know, conclusion, this is a brand new world we're entering into. It's more so from the, I'll call it the myriad of applications of circumstances that are going to arise. Yes, there are policy changes, and you've heard me talk about that. No question about it, you need to do that. But really, at the end of the day, what's going to happen here is you're going to have permutations that you hadn't even thought of that relate to what is going to be pervasive use. And the inability to really understand what the level of impairment is, the inability to detect, and the occupational health and safety obligation that says you have to take all precautions, every precaution, reasonable in the circumstances. So it is a challenge for employers. There's no question about it. All of that with a view to saying the fundamental legal obligation that you have is a human rights one, right across Canada, is to accommodate up to undue hardship. And that is a very onerous obligation, as you've heard me touch on in part today. So you can ask with respect to a recreational use versus a medicinal use. There is certainly a clear difference there and will impact how you respond to that. You're going to have to fulfill that duty to accommodate. It's not impressionistic. You can't just say we don't like this kind of person who's doing this in our environment. No, it doesn't work that way. You have to really demonstrate to medical certification that you cannot accommodate that individual to perform the essential duties of the job to undue hardship. And so now certainly is the time to look at your drug and alcohol policies and make sure they are updated, as well as training. Make sure they understand you cannot smoke in the building. Make sure they understand they cannot smoke at the holiday party. So that, folks, as I see, we are at 1 o'clock in the Eastern time zone anyways. So thank you very much for spending the time with us. And once again, if you have any follow-up questions, feel free to reach out to John, and perhaps we can have a follow-up conversation. So thanks all once again, and have a great day.